hope that everyone is enjoying the windy afternoon. It's windy here in Brooklyn, and I've been riding my bike more and get hit by gusts of wind. It's supposed to be, I don't know technically what it is, but it supposedly gusts up to 60 miles per hour today. And I've been riding my bike and like not moving because the wind is blowing me so hard. It's great fun, let me tell you. I'm very excited for our show today, and thank you for joining me. As humans, we enjoy finding wisdom in ancient texts, and as far as I can tell, kissing as a romantic or sexual act has been depicted in the Bible and Kama Sutra, and Cleopatra has been cited as an early master of the art, but strangely, none of those references include the first blown kiss. I'm wondering if it was Cleopatra. I can picture her, you know, using her wiles. But maybe it was something that came along later. I don't know if you know. If you do, let me know. Anyways, my name is Swan, and I'm blowing you kisses from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop. And you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this is Ink and Worm. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is Amber Sparks, and I'll go ahead and introduce her, and then we'll give her a call. She is a writer, editor. Her most recent book, The Unfinished World and Other Stories, came out in January of this year. And her prior works include May We Shed These Human Bodies, collaboration with Robert Kloss for The Desert Places, which is beautiful. And she's also been featured in a handful of collections, anthologies, and has a very impressive list of published essays and short works of fiction. So very excited to have her today, and we are going to give her a call and see if she'll do a quick reading for us from her new book, The Unfinished World. And if you are a fan of short stories, I would highly recommend this. It was beautiful, surprising, stunning. It definitely was a book for me that as I was reading, I just kept thinking about it. And when I was not able to read because I was working or commuting or whatever, having to do the things like make dinner, I was thinking about the story. So if you're interested in an experience that's a little bit like that, I would definitely check it out. So let's give Amber a call.
Hello.
Hi, Amber. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us today. So I introduced you and talked a little bit about your book, The Unfinished World, and how captivating it was for me as a reading experience. And I told my listeners we're going to hear from you, excerpt from the book, and then any introduction you're welcome to do.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just going to read a really short piece. I don't want to, you know, take up too much of everybody's time on a Sunday, but this is a piece called Take Your Daughter to the Slaughter, which is, if anybody out there is a metal fan, they'll appreciate the title reference. But this is sort of a piece that I wrote. I'm actually originally from Wisconsin, and the hunting is huge, right?
Uh-huh.
So I wrote, so it's like at like half of the school when I was in high school would get out for the first day of hunting season. They would actually be excused. Now I don't think I make any secret of the fact that I'm not a big fan of hunting, for sports. So, I sort of wrote this piece, but it's a little bit, oblique in its criticism. So you'll see what I mean, I think. So this is Take Your Daughter to the Slaughter. Our fathers wake us before dawn. They wake us and we rise, confused at first and then excited, remembering what today is, remembering what we will become with a little practice, a little patience, a steady eye and hand. Today is the opening day of werewolf season. Today we leave our dresses, our heels, our crinolines and crystals in the closet, and we take our camouflage out of storage. We check the contents of our day packs, map, matches, knife, first aid kit, water, trail mix, tree stand, safety belt, compass. We shower and spray ourselves down with odor neutralizer. We don our blaze orange vest and check our ammo, fingering the bright rows of silver bullets, pretty and promising as the moon, get it built out and string them on a necklace like bloody lumpen beads. Some of the older girls have necklaces so long they drape them round too. When we set up our stands, we feel a little fear, an icicle thrill at the thought of teeth and claws. We know that if we slip up, we could be bitten. We could be killed. We know that we could fail. it is important. It is our town that we succeed.
I feel a little bad interrupting you, but would you mind starting that last paragraph over? For some reason, there's a lot of distortion
on my end.
Yeah.
Let me move over close to the window in my apartment. When we set up our stands, we feel a little fear, an icicle thrill at the thought of teeth and claws. We know if we slip up, we could be bitten. We could be killed. We know that we could fail. It is important. It is vital to our town that we succeed. We have spent the year learning how to use our rifles, diligently attending target practice after school, at shooting ranges, and on decoys in the fields when the weather allows. Some of us feel sorry for the werewolves. Some of us do not want to kill. A soft thunk of bullet in flesh, a thing apart from the hard, clean splintering of wood and paint. Our fathers remind us of what we already know. The werewolves are a pestilence, a plague upon our forests, and killing them makes a good sport and a kind deed. There are too many werewolves, our fathers tell us. If we do not cull the herd, they will starve to death come winter. They will spread disease and decay. This is what fathers and daughters have always done in our town, they say. This is a good and righteous way to live. And so we nod and we learn the proper way to clean our rifles, to use a compass, to scout a location, to field dress a dead werewolf. And so we come every year in our time to the hunt. We crouch beside our fathers in the brush. We hold our breath. We watch a family of werewolves rip the meat from a deer carcass in the clearing. We are silent and still. We are eager to prove that we are good daughters. One large wolf, a male, leaves the pack and ambles towards us. We shiver in the cold and the tight grip of fear. A small girl was eaten only last year, her father helpless to act as she was dragged away by a furious and wounded wolf. We blink, and hear the wolf stop sniffing, and here is an unobstructed broadside shot, and here are our fathers mouthing, shoot, and here is our shot flying true and playing skin and muscle just below the shoulder. Here is the unearthly howl, and our blood freezes to our bones to hear it. Here is the werewolf, here is the glassy-eyed stare, here is the twitch and the moan, and here is the carcass on the ground and our father's hands on our shoulders, strong and proud. Here is our first kill. With the help of our fathers, we dress the werewolf and drag it to our trucks. Later, we will dig the bullets out and string them, silver over our throats. Later, we will eat the hearts of the men they slowly become. We will share this meat with our fathers, and we will warm our shame at that howl, our sadness at that last dissolve of paw to hand. Our fathers will hold their palms up and smile.
It's incredible. Thank you. That's like part of the haunting nature that's somewhat of a theme throughout the stories. You're kind of, I don't know, do they just stick with you, oddly? Have you read Jenny Lawson's book, Let's Pretend This Never Happened?
No. Uh-uh.
Oh, it's hilarious. I when you mentioned hunting, my father was a hunter. And growing up, I had an experience of I thought he was away hunting and came home, walked in the garage and walked right into the carcass of an elk that had been like hanging in front of the door. And I'm reading her book, Let's Pretend This Never Happened. And she's has a wonderful excerpt with lots of explicit words about doing a similar thing. And I was like, what? How many people on this planet have actually walked into like a carcass of an animal on accident?
Possibly several.
Yeah, I guess it's more common than you would think. So were you exposed to hunting through your family or just based on the community you lived in?
Just the community. So like my parents and my family, nobody hunts. We actually moved to Wisconsin from elsewhere. And so that was not something that I'd been exposed to previously. So it was very strange to like all of a sudden have, you know, the teacher announced that half of the school was not going to be there because they were all, you know, out for deer season or for the first day of deer season. So that was, and then, you know, I don't think I ever saw anyone like field dress an animal or anything like that. I definitely saw some carcasses hanging in garages.
But you were wise enough to like move slowly and not walk into them.
No, I definitely never had that experience. So, and I should say, I'm not, you know, part of the reason I actually wrote this story isn't because I'm just like, I'm going to, you know, proselytize against hunting.
It was
more of a trying to process it because, as you probably, since you have a dad that's a hunter, I'm sure, you know, it's sort of like there's all this, you know, tradition and family time and, you know, community.
Bonding. It's totally bonding.
Right, all kinds of, yeah, there's like that, all that kind of stuff, you know, wrapped up in it. So it's very much not just, you know, I have had friends that were like bitterly opposed to the idea of hunting and killing something, but they did it because it was like the only way that they could, you know, bond with their dad. So
Yeah, I think my cousin had that experience, and I've talked to her. She shot an elk with a bow and arrow, and I'm like, wow, you are a badass. But I could never do that. But she talked about it was one of the most like spiritual experiences of her life, just like bringing down this majestic creature, you know. So I don't know. I'm not for or against. I think you have to choose your own path. But I do think it's worthy of mentioning that you take something, you know, maybe that you don't understand or like a seed of an experience like hunting, and you craft this story. Is that your process? Is you like just like find these gems in real life and then like, I don't know, elaborate on them and create this other world where it's like a thing?
That's certainly, yeah. I mean, that's definitely one of the things that always motivates me to write. You know, if there's something that I'm thinking about a lot and I find myself, you know, sort of unable to think about it in a critical way, because there's just so much complexity to it, I tend to want to write about it in a fictional sense. And usually, that also means, you know, world building in terms of something that's more fantastical. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I like for another kind of writer would write a story about, you know, finding an elk or, hunting for deer or whatever.
Yeah.
And it would be a very realistic story and, you know, examine moral complexity in father-daughter relationships. And that's just not the way I write. So I have to look at things in a sort of different way. So, you know, werewolves.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we're hunting werewolves. And this is what it would be like.
That's a leap.
And to parallel that with another story from the collection, there's an online interview of you talking about the janitor in space and just talking about how you met this person, but you knew you couldn't write about them. But then you kind of focused on the fact that they were a janitor and the fact that they were so private and like withdrawn and isolated. And that's kind of where the story grew from. And so I'm just seeing that as like a interesting theme.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely, I think pretty true. I tend to write about things that I've read, things that I've witnessed I find that there's not enough written about them, or people haven't examined them in the way that I want to examine them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually the impetus for me to write something. The woman in question with the janitor in space was, she's the subject of the movie Badlands, and there's been a few other pieces that are sort of about her.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never seen anything that really delved into sort of her perspective and not only her perspective when she was young, which is, you know, very different, but I found out that this woman had essentially lived her, you know, is still alive and had been living this very, very quiet private life. And I was I'd never read anything about that. And now of course I know why, because, you know, that's not fair to put her in the public when she is so private, which I kind of realized halfway through writing a piece, but I still wanted to explore the idea of, you know, how, if you'd done something so terrible, how would, and you'd done it so young, and gotten out of prison so young, how would you spend the rest of your life? And, you know, how would you try to atone?
How do you build on that? Yeah. And you kind of started as more flash fiction, and then your stories have gotten longer over the years. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I would say so. And even more so, I actually started with poetry. So I don't know. That's a whole progression.
Yeah. The growth of work. I'd love for you to talk about your experience with short stories, because as I understand, it's kind of a hard niche market to get into. A lot of publishers won't publish short stories because they don't typically sell very well.
Yes. This is very true. And that I actually had kind of a miraculous experience. I had the typical discouraging experience,
yeah.
And then I had a miraculous experience. So my first book, and I've told this story before, but it was literally the last. So Curbside Splendor published my first book. They're a Chicago publisher. They're mm-hmm. really awesome. And they were literally the last people that I had could go to for that collection, for mm-hmm. Maybe Shed These Human Bodies. I'd submitted it to everyone else. Everyone else said no. A lot of people said, "We really like your writing. Can you send us a novel?" And I was like, "No, I can't because I don't have one." So because I'm not a novelist. So then finally I found out from a friend that this, press, Curbside Splendor, was going to be sort of starting a new thing. They were brand new at the time. And they were like, "Oh, you would be, perfect for the press." So I sent them my collection, and they, were super, super excited about it, which is great. And I think partially because it was a new press, they were sort of willing to take a chance on something that other folks weren't necessarily willing to do. And then when it came time for me to send out my second short story collection, I sent it everywhere, or my agent sent it everywhere. By that time I had an agent, and, no go, everywhere. And again, "Wow, we love the writing. It's so great. Can you send us a novel?" Mm. And I actually gave up on the collection and started working on a novel, because I was like, "All right, fine. If that's what it takes to get my short story collection published, I'll write you guys a dang novel." Yeah. And so I wrote a novel, and then I started sending out the novel, and we actually sent it to one of the editors that we sent it to, who is now my editor over at LiveWrite, was like, "I love it, but can you send us a short story collection?" I was like,
"What?
That's amazing." What? Yes. That never happens.
No.
So, she
usually she was the like, usually I, the short story is like the courtesy of like, "Here, you wrote a book. We'll let you have your little cute collection of short stories."
Right. Exactly. Like, exactly. We know it won't sell, but here you go. Yeah. So I was amazed. I was like, "Are you sure?" But I talked to her, and she was so enthusiastic about the collection, and had just really seen something in the novel, which hilariously was that I was not a novelist. I was a short story writer. And really the novel should be a short story. So she said, "Let's do this, but can we make the novel a novella instead, and have it be sort of the cornerstone of the book?"
And that
and
became
said,
the unfinished work.
Sure. Yes, exactly. So that I don't think is a process that very many people go through to publish short stories. But it was, it was really nice. And now the funny part is I actually am working on a novel. Mm-hmm. Not because I, feel like I have to now, but because, in fact, I think they'd probably rather have a short story collection, but, because I'm really curious to see if that's something I can actually do.
Yeah.
Now that I've done a couple of short story collections, or am I just going to be not just, but am I more of an Alice Munro or somebody like that?
Yeah. Like finding where you fit into the scheme of things. I think that's, I'm not published, but I think that's the process I'm figuring out too, of like, I don't want to pigeonhole myself into like, I do this, but I also don't know what I'm doing well and what I could, what my potential is. Yeah.
It is an interesting process. And it's kind of funny because you're always going to find that nobody really agrees on what they think you do well. So, mm-hmm. There are people who are like, "Oh man, I sure wish you wouldn't have not stopped writing flash fiction, but I'm not a big fan of your longer stories. Uh-huh. I like your flash." And then there's other people that are like, "I'm so glad you're finally starting to write longer stories. Your flash is fine, but
Yeah, but they wanted more.
Yeah.
Well, that leads into a theory I have about books being a conversation. So it just depends on who you're talking to, I guess. Like when a reader's reading something, they're having their own conversation, and 9 times out of 10 it actually has nothing to do with you or the content. It's just the conversation that they're having for whatever reason. I also think that curiosity is a great reason to write a novel.
Why not, right?
I'm just curious if I can do it.
Curious and probably crazy, but yes.
Always crazy. I think Alice in Wonderland had it right when it said the best people are mad.
No, that's, I actually, I totally agree about the conversation. And I think that that's, probably one of the most exciting things for me about having a book out is seeing, you know, like letting it go into the world and letting people sort of make of it what they will. And it's always really fascinating for me to see, like, you know, especially reading Goodreads reviews, which I know you're not really supposed to do, but because those aren't,
they're very nice to you on Goodreads. I saw, I was like, oh, yay.
Yeah, no, they have been surprisingly wonderful, which is great. And it's nice because they're real people. Not to say that critics are not real people, but you know, they're not people who are like writing in this sort of, literary criticism sort of language. They're just writing like, oh, hey, this is a story that I really liked and here's why. Mm-hmm. Which is always really interesting to me because like, you know, I'll read some of those things and be like, oh, well, that's actually not what the story is about at all. They totally got it wrong. And then I'm like, wait a minute. No, they didn't. Like, that's what the story is about for them. So it's not my story anymore. It belongs to the reader now. So that's actually, at first it's something that's weird to get used to, but then it's really cool after a while because you're like, oh man, I wrote a story about so many things and I didn't even realize it, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah. Or just those interpretations and those insights that you go back and reread it and you're like, yeah, that could have been in there. I didn't intend for that to be in there, but that could have been a part of it.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's true too for the negative reviews. You sort of, I've never really, I know people probably say this, but I really am not like bothered by them because, you know, they're just, it's so people's subjective experience. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it ends up being, you know, I really don't like short stories. And so I didn't like this collection of short stories.
You're like,
so
well, it's like,
there's
thanks
really
for reading.
Nothing that I can do about that. Yeah. So
like, thanks for, you know, plowing through it, despite the fact that you hated it.
right. Or, you know, my book shipped 5 days late from Amazon. And so, you know, 1 star. I'm like, well, that's not I can't do anything about that.
You're
so.
Like, well, c'est la vie. I am curious. I've been hearing a little bit lately about a lot of writers who write for a living are promoting people to have day jobs and then write on the side. And like, you know, the idea that you're going to be a writer and support your life by writing is not really realistic based on the changing industry. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
I have,
because you're a mom and you have a lot going on, I'm sure. And writing, yeah, I'm sure, isn't the only thing you do all day, every day.
No. In fact, you can probably hear my kid right now. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not. I've never been a full-time writer. And I've always had another job that's unconnected to writing, in part because I actually don't have an MFA. I don't like come from any kind of like academic background in terms of writing. Actually, my academic background is actually in theater. So
I was curious because I wasn't explicit in my research. I was like, okay, I don't see any like graduated from here in MFA, you know, which intrigued me. And that's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah. No. So, you know, aside from the theater thing, what I actually do for my day job, I'm a digital director at a labor union. So, I direct our sort of online and social media program. So that's like, you know, really a completely separate world. And I've been doing that. I've been working for the labor union in one capacity or another for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. So basically the whole time that I've really been, you know, seriously writing and seriously submitting and publishing, I've had this like pretty onerous day job, actually. I don't mean onerous and like that it's terrible, but it's time consuming.
And it's like the 9-to-5-ish type thing.
Yeah, it's really more you know, a lot of evenings and weekends and travel and stuff like that too. So it's a job that takes up a lot of time. So that's always been something that's been sort of interesting to me, balancing writing and balancing work and balancing reading and life and all this other stuff. And of course now, you know, throwing a baby into the mix is, you know, complicating everything by a million, but it's been sort of, but I feel like, to go back to your question, I'm always sort of, you know, I wish that we could support ourselves by writing, right? I mean, God, that would be, what an awesome world that would be. But I'm always sort of like, you know, I'm pretty much of a, I've always been a pragmatist, and I feel sort of bad for people when they're like so let down that that's not actually possible, because I don't think that it's really actually ever been possible, hardly, except for like this very brief. Yeah, there was like one select few people, and maybe there was this like very brief golden age in like, you know, the 40s and 50s where people could sort of, you know, Hemingway and Faulkner and all these people could actually, well, even Faulkner had another job, but they could sort of,
well, and I do
Hemingway,
think,
right? And, he was a reporter, yeah.
Yeah, well, and even just to interject, I do think that a lot of times that's something we don't talk about, of like, oh, this wonderful novelist, and you're like, but they were an accountant. Like, they just wrote
right
outside of that. And that's not something that's,
right,
like, readily available information. People know writers as writers, kind of almost regardless
that's
sometimes
exactly
of what
right
they actually did for a living.
That's very true. And, like, and there are some, you know, there's some writers who've chosen to sort of cobble together the living. And usually it's a pretty meager living, which some people
and
are
very
fine
supported
with,
by lots of generous people.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then some people are not fine with that. Like, you know, I love the example I always love is Wallace Stevens. I've actually written about him and his job, because he was an insurance adjuster, which is like literally the most boring job I could possibly think of. And he loved it. And it was like this completely separate life. And like no one really got at all what the hell he was doing with poetry. And he, you know, and he kind of loved that, that he had this like completely separate, you know, very boring, orderly life, and then had this life of the mind on the other side. And I think there's, you know, a fair amount of writers who do that. And it doesn't mean that you have to, or that you have to enjoy it, but
yeah, I agree with you. I think that there's something satisfying about being different people and like stepping into completely different roles that would surprise anyone. Like, I met someone last night who was a drag king, and like you look at her and she seemed like a normal girl, but she also dresses up as a man and dances on stage. Like, I was like, wow,
that's
the
awesome
things you never know just by looking at someone.
No, I think that's great. And I think I always feel like, you know, so the whole MFA, NYC, blah, 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 like I have no dog in that fight. And I think people should just do whatever they want to do. But I do feel like there's maybe a lot of people making themselves miserable who go and get an MFA, which is super awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then feel
pressure
the only
to produce
thing that they should do is teach.
Yeah.
That's even if they don't really want to teach, or that's not something that they're particularly passionate about. And you know, I wish that more people felt like they could, you know, sort of maintain this like identity of a writer without having to sort of do all of the things that you do as a writer, you know, MFA, teach, do this, do that. It's like you can be a writer and be, you know, work on a factory floor. And that's,
and especially,
you know,
I think you have to find your own path. I think that's part of the process. And especially like finding your own voice and what you have to write about, I think. I do want to talk a little bit about some like more formal aspects of your stories. So you... a lot of times you'll switch the voice and the point of view between one story and the next, which is what I actually love about short story collections is, I don't know, these snapshots. It's like, oh, wow, that's so interesting. And then you turn the page and it's like a completely different feeling and a completely different, you know, like setup. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, your point of view and kind of how you decide who's going to tell this story?
That's a pretty important aspect for my stories. And a lot of times I can never tell the story until I actually really figure that out. And a lot of times it's what makes it click for me. So, you know, it's usually gotta be somebody a lot of times it's an observer, right? My stories, I think, are very much sort of, the stories told by people on the fringes of the people that are sort of observing things.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than like the main players a lot of times. And so a lot of times that's who ends up telling the story. And for example, I'm trying to think of, got the book in front of me. Oh yeah. So We Were Holy Once, story of the murderous, you know, Bender family in the Wild West. I had been sitting on that story for so long because it's a true story. And, you know, I'd been like writing it in this sort of third person, like very sort of Western, you know, Western-y voice. And it just was not working and not working. And I finally had put it aside. And then I started thinking about who could really tell this story. And, you know, I had read somewhere, and it's interesting because the story is true, but it's almost apocryphal in that, like people don't really know many of the details, even about the benders, right? So, mm-hmm. I had read somewhere that maybe the little boy was a mute, although, you know, some people thought maybe he was just pretending to be a mute. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knows if this is even true, but I was like, that's who needs to tell the story, is the little boy who's, you know, because he's sort of a little bit more removed from everything. And mm-hmm. and once I figured that out, then I figured out that the sister was the really sort of the oppositional force and the main player in the story, and that it sort of took off from there. I think a lot of times too, actually, that sort of ties in with somebody in an interview just recently brought up how many sort of sibling pairings I have in my stories.
Mm, yeah.
And I'd never really thought about it that much, but then I started looking and realizing I did. And I think a lot of that is not so much anything to do with siblings in particular, but that I really like to tell stories from oppositional points of view. So rivalries, mm-hmm. You know, people who are very close and have very passionate, you know, sort of competition or rivalry between them, or people who are very close but very different. And I think a lot of that tends to just be siblings, because that's kind of how siblings are. So that's another way, sort of, in terms of point of view, to figure out who's going to tell the story. And some of it too is, you know, you tell like there's the trap of the second or third person story,
mm-hmm.
which I say trap because so easily that can, or not, sorry, not third person, but first person plural, because both of those can be so gimmicky, if done wrong. But I think when used well, in the right context, they can be really, really effective. I particularly like to use first person plural very sparingly, but the story that I just read, actually, mm-hmm. because I think that sort of works in almost a fairy tale, fable sense.
It makes it ethereal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I do, I agree with you. I really like, that's one of the things I love about short story collections too, is that you're jumping into so many different people's skin mm-hmm. in the course of one book. And that's just so, I think that's so fun.
Yeah. Another question I have is there a character that you've written about or that you are potentially going to write about who is kind of like haunting you or sticking with you in like a I don't know, maybe just a character that has resonated more than the others?
That's a good question. I think, you know, the main story, The Unfinished World, in the book, the novella, you know, Set was, who's the main character in that story, sort of stuck with me and is sort of still with me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that might be just in part, not so much his character, but just the fact that it was a novel, right? So, mm-hmm. there was just so much to him, and the novel was even more about him specifically. So, you know, I still think about him and his character every now and then. And it was like hard to leave that book behind, or hard to leave that story and that character behind. But I'd say less character per se than time period.
Ah.
Like, for example, you can probably tell from the book, there's probably like four or five stories in there that are about either the 1920s or the early part of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, I'm obsessed with that time period. And I just keep going back to it and keep writing from it. And, you know, World War One and, you know, sort of the beginnings of modernity. And I think that's why, is because, you know, it's really the world on the precipice,
yeah.
You know, the sort of the juxtaposition between the old and the new. And it was this really, this time of things breaking open, which I think there's just so much, you know, so much in there to write about. But I don't know. I'd say it's weird. And then sometimes I'll look at my stories and be like, you know, I should really stop writing about the 1920s because that's probably kind of weird. I don't know what people make of that, but I'll probably keep doing it.
Yeah. And I am.
Well, that's good.
I am curious also in terms of like curating a collection, like how many stories do you start with and how many are cut? And I know you talked a little bit in one article about kind of like finding the themes and how sometimes mm-hmm. a story you love just kind of doesn't really fit with the mood of the collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's so I think we started with, I don't remember the number, but like we definitely cut, my editor and I cut about maybe 10 stories out of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even more. And some of them were, you know, very short pieces, but there was a couple that were quite long that we cut. It was mostly, it wasn't that we didn't like the stories, but it was, and then I actually ended up writing some more also that came into the book and replaced it, including We Were Holy Once. I think the ones that we cut, they didn't fit the theme. And it's not like there's an overt, you know, theme, like you could say in one
feeling. It's like a mood, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's a feeling. And I think the stories that got cut were much, for the most part, much more sort of, I think they lived in a more realism-centered universe. They were much more realistic. Not that there aren't some realistic stories in here, but I think even the more realistic stories tend to have a certain fantastic like quality that hangs over them,
mm-hmm.
Or mythical quality, even if they're taking place in real time and space. And I think the ones that we caught were just much more sort of in the gritty realism vein, I guess.
Yeah.
And so they just didn't quite, they just kind of took you out of it, which we didn't want.
Thank you. I do want to also mention you just posted, or you guys just had an article published on Fanzine entitled mm-hmm. Where Wonder Lives Online, Why Instagram is the New Cabinet of Curiosities. And I just want to,
yes.
I'm going to take some time and read the first paragraph because I love the way it opens. And it also speaks to something that Joseph Rippey said about your work. After the first sentence, there's no telling where a spark story might take you. And there's definitely no telling what that first sentence might be. And so in this article, you open up by saying, we collect because we love, we show that shit off because we want other people to know what we love. We pile up our preferences and spill it out online in life and love, an extension of our own built selves. We talk about collectors, the roots, phyla, and you go into figures, formal names, bibliophile, phyla. I can't pronounce these words, but how.
Neither can I.
And I get nervous too sometimes, but this makes a lot of etymological sense. The roots come from the Greek word phylos, meaning loving. When it comes to gathering up what we love and putting it on display, the cabinet of curiosities may have been the peak of individual collectors' reign, certainly in ostentatious self-expression through curation. But is the cabinet of curiosities dead except in modern art projects and self-styled collector eccentrics? Or does it live on in a more egalitarian forms online? As I was reading, I was like, if you knew nothing about Instagram and you created an account and just followed all of these accounts that you cite here, you'd have a really interesting and inspiring feed going on. So some great resources there. I just wanted to do a quick shout out. And I also just love that idea of collecting because you love and like sharing what you love. And then I do like to end my shows with rapid fire questions. Just talking
sure.
a little bit about your interests and influences. Is there a book that you have not gotten around to reading?
Like a big, you know, giant kind of book or?
Yeah, or just something you like keep meaning to read and it keeps coming back and then you just don't read it?
Yes, actually. It's actually a book by Kristen, what is it called? I'm actually walking over to look at it right now. Sigrid Undset's Kristen Lavin's Daughter,
mm-hmm.
Which is like this huge epic about a Norwegian woman. And it's Norwegian? Swedish woman? I forget now. But it's supposed to be amazing and it's this classic and one of my friends actually recommended it and it's like just so huge that it's been sitting on my, it's one of those terrible books that's been sitting on my shelf mocking me for so long.
I think sometimes size matters with books. You just look at it and you're
some
like,
people love that. But
oh yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're busy and you look at it and you're like, no, I can't
yep.
nibble at this for the next 5 years.
Like, yes, yes. It's epic too. So it's like, oh my God.
Is there a book that you remember your parents reading to you?
Oh my God, many, many books. I remember actually the Dick and Jane books, which is really lame, but but they actually got them at a garage sale when I was really little. And I remember those are the first books that I actually like physically have memories of, and that's how I learned to read.
Yeah, they were good at learning how to read. That's definitely amazing. I haven't thought about those in a really long time. It's kind of a fun throwback. Do you have any rituals or routines related to your writing?
No, that's a terrible answer, but
no, it's a great answer.
I never have, and especially now with a baby, it's the only thing I have is I need to be able to write on my phone. That's it.
You use Evernote?
No, I just use like the stupid notes feature on my iPhone.
Awesome.
It's terrible, but
oh, it works. It sounds like it's been working. Do you just like write as things like strike you as you're going throughout your day, or do you like
Pretty
structure?
Much. And also like if there's a baby sitting on my lap, or you know, I'm feeding her or whatever, like it's like something that I can do really easily. I can even use dictation. When I was writing this summer when I was on maternity leave, I wrote a lot through dictation actually. So
I'm a fan of the voice to text aspect of phones. Sometimes you need to talk and not write.
Yep.
I've noticed from talking to people that there's typically a book that kind of transitioned you from child to teenager. There's like a book that like made you feel things or just think about things differently. Is there a book that kind of influenced that transition into puberty for you?
That's a good question. Because I can think of books that were very like influential on me as a child, mm-hmm. and then books that were influential as an adult, but I'm not sure the transition per se. I mean, I guess there was always, you know, it's actually a pseudonym, Victoria Holt, and I don't know what her real name is, but there were like these sort of trashy historical romances, but they weren't like, they were just a step above like a romance, right? Like a romance novel. So they were more historical than they were a romance, and there wasn't just like blatant sex in them. But there was definitely enough bodice ripping that you felt like, you know, you were getting something good. Yeah, especially when you're like 13 or whatever. So when I was like, you know, 12, 13 years old and going to the library, I would sort of just like every time I would get like another Victoria Holt book. And it was kind of funny because I think I was just as much interested in the actual like the historical aspects as I was in like the salacious aspects.
Awesome.
But I do remember that being sort of
the best of both worlds. Nice. Is there writing advice that you've been given that's like changed your writing, or that you kind of visit when you sit down to write?
I mean everything helps, and there's a lot of different things I've learned from people, but there's really two things that I've taken away that I'll like remember forever. And one of them is Michael Kimball, who's this fantastic fiction writer, sort of does this, I forget what it's called. It's like the 90-minute MFA or something like that. It's maybe 60-minute, but it's a really great, he basically does like a writing session in a short amount of time, which teaches you everything. And one of the things he talked about was, just write, even if you just write, a couple of pages a year, eventually you'll get a book done. I'm paraphrasing him, but like, you know, he's like, it doesn't, you know, you may feel like you're writing slower than everyone else, and you may feel like you're never going to get anything done, but if, you know, in 10 years, you'll have a book, right?
Yeah, so, just keep chipping away. I'll have to check that out. Nice.
So that's definitely always stuck with me as somebody who, like we talked about, you know, sort of has a lot of other stuff going on. And then one of my friends, actually told me one time, and I stole her trick. She said, when I've got writer's block and I'm totally stuck and I don't know how to go on, I just pick up a random book of poetry and leaf through it. And I just, you know, point my finger on the page and I take like 10 sentences at random from the poetry collection and put them on the page. And then I work from there. Obviously not stealing the poem, you know, all that source material goes away once you've sort of been inspired. And I swear I've never had writer's block since I started using that trick.
Nice. It's like a practice I do called river writing. So it's seated in poetry. You read a poem, you find the line that is jumping off the page to you, And then you use that as a starting point for a free write, a timed free write.
Yeah.
And it's called river writing because, you know, it just kind of flows and it's really lyrical, but it's also, it's kind of like the writing equivalent of painting. You can work with different layers and kind of build from this thread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And I think because my writing tends to be, everything comes from language. That's the first place that everything sort of starts. So that to me is just like a natural starting point for, it's not ideas, it's language.
Nice. Great. Well, I guess we are running close to the end of time. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your afternoon to chat with me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And yeah, me too.
I will make sure to post any, I guess all of the links that you sent me, but is there anything else you want to promote other than The Unfinished World? Find it in your local bookstore. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's in like every indie bookstore in New York, as far as I know, or most of them. So,
and events, you have events on your website, ambersparks.com.
I do, although I'm actually in the process of making myself a new website, which should be up shortly.
Nice.
So then I'll have all updated events.
That's exciting. All right, great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I will send you a link to the podcast. And you can also catch it on Stitcher, iTunes, and Audioboom.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Of course. Enjoy your Sunday afternoon.
Thanks. You too.
Bye. So that was Amber Sparks, author of a new collection of fiction out this January, The Unfinished World. And hopefully you enjoyed that conversation and are having a good afternoon. So I do like to do an actionable takeaway, so some sort of free write. And I've been experimenting a lot. I think I've mentioned the last couple weeks, I've been experimenting a lot with point of view. And I feel like that is something that kind of pushes you past what you would write ordinarily, because it allows you to step into different frames of mind. So I would say find a point of view that you don't feel comfortable writing in and try writing in that point of view. I think I mentioned last week the story I wrote in second person, saying you, you, you. And it was an interesting experience for me, and I actually got some good feedback from it. So if you are so inclined, you can try, and please send me anything that comes of that. I love reading what people write based on my suggestions, because it makes me excited and makes me feel heard. Also, I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I'm figuring out the socials. So if you want to help me be digitally social or, you know, in person social, you can reach out to me at any of those websites. And yeah, nice stuff. Let's see. I finished my class with Gotham Writers, and that was really an amazing experience in learning some of the structure of writing and also having external deadlines to write. I'm looking to form some sort of community writing space, preferably in person, because I do feel like there is power in person. So putting out feelers, if you want to join my writing community and read the words that I write and I can read the words that you write and we can tell each other what we think, hit me up and we can build something together. Empty Orchestra will be next, exploring the dynamic relationship between song and singer in the context of karaoke with Angelica and Amanda. Thank you for listening. This is Ink and Worm. You've been listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and we're broadcasting live out of the basement of the Velo Bike Shop. Very exciting. If you do want to become a part of the community, if you like what you hear, if you're curious to learn more about the shows and the people, can check out the website. I don't know if our new one is up, but then also you can consider becoming a donator, supporting, you know, the equivalent of buying us a cocktail, if that's an analogy that works for you. You know, take us out for a drink. It's like $1 a month, $12 per year. Would you buy Radio Free Brooklyn a drink in order to keep independent local media alive? There's some perks to donating, so you can check that all out at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Also, you can connect to community events and other things that are going on in the world of Brooklyn and the world at large. I will leave you with a word. Take it or leave it. Apricity.